So I don't know how your week has gone, but you being here is a win, because talking about, because just the fact that you're here and we're talking about this stuff in this series on depression and anxiety and insecurity is a win for you, and it's a win for everybody else that's here, because one of the things that happens with all of us in these things, which are universal. Hi, Gracie. Glad you're here. No, she's fine. She's fine. Glad she's here. One of the things that is near universal with all of this stuff is that all of us experience these things, and we also hear these same lies that go through us, that I'm all alone in this. I've got to keep this a secret. I can't let anybody know. I've got to try to figure this out on my own. And we all wrestle with this. And so when you're at work, or where you're at school, or when you're not all alone in this, that somebody that is around you has or is struggling with this across the office or across the classroom or across the street. And so by you being here today and me being here, that we're being together and saying, hey, none of us are alone in this. These lies that we all kind of live with when we experience these things, that they're not true. They're not true. Everybody's story is a little different, and we wrestle with things in different ways, but we're not alone in this stuff. And I think that just kind of lets it take some of the sickness of secrecy out, you know, that we can just be and open up to each other about this. And it's so important that happens in this place, because we are a holistic group. We are a church. We are people that come with all of our issues and our hang-ups, and we work on becoming sane and sober and healthy together as we walk towards Jesus together. And so it's important to do that in this place. And one of the coolest things that I love about, weird thing to say, but that I love about all of these things of anxiety and depression and all that kind of stuff, is that even in our brokenness, that God uses people in our brokenness, that finds the ways that we are, we're flawed, where we're hurting, where we've suffered before. And that when we let God do this, that God doesn't want us to suffer, doesn't want us to hurt. But when God can fill that up with love and with purpose. And so often that we are, we have the most compassion and the most wisdom to give to other people in the places that we have been hurt and that we've suffered. And I think that's a spot of hope for all of us. So, same thing this week that we did last week. Gonna just define what anxiety is. Share a little something about what Jesus and the Bible has to say about it, and then just get into some real practical stuff. So, and then we'll go into the time of response after that. So, to define anxiety, there's a lot of little things that are kind of around anxiety that I think need to be fleshed out and pushed away a little bit. Stress is one of those. Stress is not anxiety. It's our body and our mind supercharging ourselves, being our bodies, to respond to a demand. It's not inherently bad. So, like, if you're going to run a race, your body is pumping out some stress. It's getting supercharged to do its best, to operate at its peak performance. Same thing when you sit down to take a test. You feel a little bit of the blood pumping, and your brain's getting oxygenated. Your body is supercharging itself to help you do its very best in this moment. It's not inherently bad. And it's not quite the same thing as anxiety. But we're going to... So fear, that's another one. Pretend with me that a 12-foot tall, 1,500-pound grizzly bear walks in the back of the room. Its hands are as... His paws are as big as my chest. Its claws are as long as my hand. We would all experience a physiological response to this bear filling up the doorway and walking through here. It's a part of our brain called the amygdala, which is an irrational part of our brain that is important, and it's in charge of keeping us alive. You know, would begin to start taking over, and would our It would pump adrenaline through our bodies, that our blood would start pumping, our breathing would pick up, our pupils would dilate, and it would begin moving us. Some of us would start moving away, like, oh, I'm not so sure about this, I'm going to walk away. Some of us would just freeze, and then other people would be like, oh, there's a bear here, I probably need to fight it. It's irrational, and we don't really pick those necessarily in those moments. But that's our amygdala trying to keep us safe and picking what it thinks is the best option there. So that is fear, and then it has another layer it's fear, but it's also terror. So like, think about the bears also grumpy and starting to like just fling people around, and then you are like right in front of terror. And that amygdala is going to absolutely take over your brain, and you are going to be out of your mind dealing with fear and terror, either fighting or running away or just freezing, curling into a ball. Okay, that's fear. So anxiety is this amazing collaborative work between your amygdala and your prefrontal cortex. Your prefrontal cortex is this thing that teenagers don't really have very well, that helps out with judgment and thinking about the future and all those sort of things. It does a lot of stuff. But when the amygdala, which is always our senses to scan our environment and search for potential threats, works in conjunction with the prefrontal cortex, which is looking out into the world and thinking ahead, they have this collaborative project called anxiety. And they work together to think about the future, all the what-ifs out there that could potentially be a threat. And a real interesting thing with this is that the more that the amygdala gets triggered, this could be, the more that we believe that our brain believes, or amygdala believes that this is a potential threat, the more that all the same physiological responses that are associated with fear are also triggered. So that means for some people that maybe even have anxiety issues or whatever, me just saying that, like, imagine a grizzly bear, 1,500-pound grizzly bear coming through, your heart's already racing, picked up a little bit. Oh my gosh, what if this happened? You know, I would run out here, I would do this, and you're feeling it in your body. So just the thought of like of a bear into the room can kind of get. You can feel it in your arms. You can feel it in your veins. Like you get on edge, short-tempered, irritable things. And then we get just anxiety attack, and that's like you are actually in front of the bear, called out of your mind terror. The amygdala has taken over when there's actually no bear in the room. A lot of people. When they experience an anxiety attack and they're not sure what's happening, they think that they're having a heart attack. It's very common. But it is the same sort of response. There could be no bear in the room, same sort of response as if there was this terrible threat, and you're sweating, blood's pumping, body's pumping, you are panicked. And people that are more susceptible to these kind of things, more susceptible to anxiety and anxiety attacks, they're people that we can have a genetic predisposition, we can have a personality disposition, and a lot of times people that have been through trauma, especially children, carry this stuff around with them. And when we know that it's particularly off is when we have an anxiety disorder. And that's how well your level of anxiety and your response to anxiety match up with reality. So a grizzly bear in Georgia walking into our church this morning, if that's a big concern for you in your life and that's just really set you off, then, you know, there's might be some anxiety disorder kind of stuff going on there, because it's not a real concern, you know, in Georgia. But this does play a useful function. So what if your amygdala and this collaborative project of anxiety is looking for potential threats, and then all of a sudden it puts together some little things that you saw in a report at work, And then you remember something that your boss said a year ago. And then you remember like getting some coffee and you heard the HR lady just say something in conversation that puts it all together, because it's always searching for threats. And you're like, oh, we might have layoffs in our company soon. Fear response, concern. I might need to look into this. I might need to get my resume together. I might need to start saving more money to prepare for this. Is this real? You know, it serves a function. So in that scenario, it's doing its job, but it is serving you really well. So it's all about how well it matches up to reality and how well your responses match up to. Two other things here. You don't have to have like a concrete thing that you're fixated on to be feeling anxiety. Like a bear, for example. So when you say, like, what are you anxious about? People that are anxious, you can just be washing the dish. There might be some underlying thing that a counselor could help you, like, dig out. But, like, you can be washing the dishes or working on your computer or whatever. And you feel it. You can feel the blood pumping through your body. And it's just it's an ongoing low-grade terror that you're just living with. And it's just there. And it kind of, for people that struggle with anxiety, that anxiety struggles on them, it just happens. And it's just there. Get counseling. And the last thing is that we talked about last week that the key word for depression is vitality. It's about your vitality being low. And with anxiety, the key word is well-being. That a lack of well-being kind of induces anxiety and makes us more susceptible to anxiety. So an anxious person easily feels in danger or threatened because they don't have as much well-being or any of that. Trauma and abuse kind of rip those things out of people's lives. So it's easy for them to feel threatened or under attack emotionally, physically, socially, all that kind of stuff. So that is, there's a lot of pieces around it that it takes a second to flesh. So here's the part that Jesus, with Jesus in this. This story that we read today, I've hated this for so long. I don't know if that's wrong for a pastor to say that, but like I've hated this story for so long, and it fits with some other things that Jesus says. So it's not out of for him to say and act this. Most things about Jesus either convict me or inspire me or challenge me in some ways, but this kind of stuff from Jesus has made me really mad, has made me like want to slam my Bible and walk away and yell at God for a while. Here's what happens. Jesus has been out teaching and preaching and stuff, and so he's tired, and he gets in a boat, and he goes to sleep, and they shove off from shore into the Sea of Galilee, and he's asleep, and he leaves the boat and the journey across the sea into the very capable hands of his disciples. Many of them are fishermen, many of them are sailors, that they have done this their entire lives. This is what they know. Some of them, it's almost all that they know. They are very competent, very skilled, very experienced in their sailing. And then suddenly, a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. So you and I, if we were in this situation, we might have reached our freak out moment when the sky becomes dark and the wind and the waves pick up and be like, oh, I'm not so sure about this. I want to find some land. I want to look at, like, I'm anxious about what comes next. You know, I would like to get to some land. Not these guys. Super chill. Super chill. They don't even, it's not even like the threshold of we've got to do something about this moment when the waves are coming over the side of the boat. Nope, that would be for sure like freaking out, yelling, shaking Jesus, wake up! We got to do something about this. No, for them it was like when the waves are coming over, not just the side of the boat, over the boat. So that the waves the boat. That was, and their experience, they'd been out to sea before, they'd seen storms, they'd been out there. So in their mind, that's the point where you start to freak out a little bit. And you wake up Jesus when the waves are going over the boat. Super chill guys. I'm not there. And so they wake up Jesus, and Jesus says to them, "You of little faith, why were you so afraid?" And then he rebukes the wind and the waves, and it was completely calm again. So he wakes up, he criticizes them for freaking out, for being angry, what might happen next. He does something amazing. He calms the storms. It's great. And then he probably goes back to sleep a little irritated with them. And that's kind of it. And they're just left like, oh, wow, that just happened. But what's the deal? What is the deal here? I think this is a perfectly legitimate situation to freak out, to be anxious about. And I think these guys were actually pretty chill, right? But in their combined experience, it told them they need to begin worrying about what happens next, because what happens next is drowning. And so when I read this story, but think that Jesus is at least a little insensitive to everyone in the boat who is not the Son of God. It's a little insensitive to tell them, "Why are you being so anxious? Just trust me." To everybody else in the boat in that storm who is not the Son of God. But this, like I said, is not uncharacteristic of Jesus. Back when he was teaching, just a couple of chapters before, he's got a crowd of people around him, people that some people were doing okay in life, some people were struggling. And why I say struggling, like they were living on the survival edge of existence. Poor back then and that time and that place was different than poor is in America today. And this is what he says to them. "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or you will drink, or about your body or what you will wear. Is life not more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? You of little faith, do not worry, saying, 'What shall we eat, and what shall we drink, and what shall we wear?' For the pagans run after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." Never disagreed with that last part. Each day will have enough trouble of its own. So Jesus is teaching these people. He's standing in front of people who are living, who almost certainly knew cold and hunger, who almost certainly knew what it's like, what the hunger was on the faces of their children. And he says, "Don't worry about food and what you're going to eat. Don't worry about warm clothing. Just don't do it. Just trust God." And now he's telling, in the middle of this storm, he's telling people who have lived around drowning probably their entire life, who have lived around the threat of drowning their whole lives, have known people that have drowned, and are now being faced with it. He says, "Why are you so anxious about this? Just trust me. Trust me." I've been so frustrated about this. When I would slam my Bible, I would want to yell at God and scream and say, "Well, maybe these people are worrying about food because they know what it means to starve. Maybe they worry about having clothes to wear because they know what it means to be in rags and cold and shivering in the night. And maybe these people are worried about drowning in the storm because they're in a storm. And they've known people who were drowned. They live in a world that God made where terrible things go wrong. Where people suffer. Where people experience loss and pain. And it just seemed too much for the Son of God to step into this world that God created, a world where people suffer, and say, "Don't worry, don't be anxious, just trust me." Seemed pretty heartless and out of touch with the reality that you and I live in. Today, though, I know better. I know better. Years of struggling and living with anxiety, going to counseling and reading self-help books and putting into practice everything I learned with the intensity that only a perfectionist, anxious individual can muster, I can say with complete confidence that I was wrong about Jesus. I was wrong. Jesus was not being a jerk. He wasn't being a jerk. In the storms of anxiety, Jesus is throwing us the only rope that really holds. In the storms of anxiety, Jesus is throwing us the only rope that really ever holds. You see, every deep breathing technique program, every mental discipline, everything else, without what Jesus is teaching, commanding us about anxiety, is like putting a Band-Aid on a hemorrhage. It helps. It alleviates, but it doesn't solve the problem. You remember what the key word is with anxiety? Well-being. Well-being. Depression was vitality. Anxiety is well-being. For whatever the reasons may be, people with anxiety lack a sense of well-being. A sense that all is well and all will be well. The sense that no matter what happens, I'm going to be okay. And there is nothing in this life for an anxious person. An anxious person searches around and looks for solid ground to like anchor their life on. But we're all going to die, and everything that we care about, we're going to lose it. And so in all of our clawing through the storm to try to find solid ground, where is it? Where is it? And for me, I know that the only solid ground that I've ever found was in this Jesus, this God with us. It's not trusting in a plan that guarantees that we won't face suffering or loss. That's going to happen. You and I are going to suffer. We are going to experience loss because we are alive in this world. But what I'm talking about here is trusting in a God who says in winning and in losing, in life, and yes, even in death, put your trust in me and all will be well. In life and in death, in winning and in losing, trust in me and all will be well. All is well and all will be well. Trust me beyond what your eyes can see, and let your well-being grow out of that. Let the deep roots of well-being grow out of this with God life. Well-being is the key word. It's the central thing. It's the central issue with anxiety. And in all the storms of anxiety, and they do feel like storms sometimes, howling, screeching, screaming storms, Jesus is showing us the only solid thing to hold on to. You see, in Jesus' lips, saying, stop worrying. Just stop it. Stop being anxious and trust in me. It's not insensitive and it's not out of touch. It's the way to life and to peace and to calm. You can't beat anxiety by wrestling with it, by fighting it. You just have to let it go. To let it rage and scream around you and through you without trying to manage it or control it. But just let it be. And let it pass in its own good time like wind through your open hand. Stop and trust me is the best thing that Jesus could have ever said to anxious people to give us solid ground and a way out of the storm. It's the same thing that God has been saying to you and to me and to people for such a long time. All the way back in the book of Deuteronomy, God says, the Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you or forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. I am with you. Don't be afraid. Isaiah 26, "You, O God, will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast on you because they trust in you." And trusting God, we find our peace. Isaiah 41, "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. I'll be with you." Hey guys, Jesus is in the boat with you. Trust me. In life and death and winning and losing. You know, I don't hate this story anymore. I don't get angry with God and angry with Jesus when I read about him saying this stuff. I love it. It's allowed me to see anxiety as a constant reminder. I used to see anxiety this way. I used to see anxiety as a constant reminder that God can't be trusted because it's always out there searching for things that could go wrong, that what ifs and what ifs and what ifs. And it was constantly pointing to evidence that God can't be trusted, that I'm not safe, the world isn't safe, that we're not all okay. And that God, maybe God doesn't care or wouldn't come through. In the Gospel of Mark, this story is also told, and there the disciples grab Jesus and they say, "Don't you care? Don't you care?" I love that. Anxiety has been a constant reminder that the world isn't safe, that I'm not okay, and that God can't be trusted and maybe doesn't care. It would tell me this lie, that this function, this collaboration would keep me safe, that it would keep me safe. The staying on guard and obsessing over problems and potential threats and that solving them before they ever arrived is what's going to, you know, you just got to feed into it, and that's what will keep you safe because it's all out there and we have to manage it and deal with it. But it's a lie. It wasn't protecting my life. It was stealing my life, stealing my energy, stealing my peace, stealing my joy, stealing my ability to be present. Now that I know better, anxiety is like my very own spiritual personal trainer. It drives me to God. It drives me to stop it and trust God, to stop it and trust God. Because it's there. It reminds me pretty often. Stop it and trust God. It's a near constant reminder to trust God and let my sense of well-being grow in this good and solid soil. It's a reminder to let this voice of God grow deep in. I am with you. I am with you. All is well and will be well. I am with you. All is well and will be well. I am with you. The voice of God. Trust me. Trust me. I'm with you in life and in death, winning and losing. I'm right there with you, and all will be well. Let's pray.